You are about to hear a remarkable press teleconference with Lester R. Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute. It's about his new book, World on Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. This 45-minute presentation with Q&A deals with the world food crisis, preventing catastrophic climate change, and reordering civilization for survival. It was recorded January 12, 2010.
Good day and welcome to the Glover Park Group World on the Edge conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Jennifer Mullen. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good morning, everyone. This is Jennifer Mullen with the Glover Park Group, and now I'll turn it over to Lester Brown.
Thanks, Jennifer. One of the things that became clear to us as we were working on World on the Edge is that there are two widely held but dangerously different views of the world and of our future. One of these is held by what I would loosely describe as natural scientists, meteorologists, hydrologists, ecologists, agronomists, etc. And they see a world that's in trouble. Meteorologists see ice melting and the possibility of losing the Greenland ice sheet and what that would mean to sea level and so forth. Hydrologists see water tables falling in so much of the world and holding out the prospect of widespread water shortages. And I could go down the list. Meanwhile, economists who do most of the advising on government policy see a very different world. If you look at economic projections by the World Bank or Goldman Sachs or Deutsche Bank, they all show the world economy continuing to grow into the indefinite future at more or less 3% a year, some of them higher than that. But they see the future as an extrapolation of the recent historical past. And the economists who make these projections don't ask questions like, will there be enough water to support this growth? Or what will be the effect on the demand for food of a world economy that doubles, and where will that food come from? Those are not questions that they ask. They're dealing with rather fundamental economic trends. And we're going to have to reconcile these views before too long, or we're going to be in over our heads in trouble. We are in the process now of destroying our natural support system, the economy's natural support systems, forests, grasslands, aquifers, soils, fisheries, you name it. And we know from the experience of earlier civilizations that no civilization survived the ongoing destruction of its natural support systems, nor will ours. In looking at these trends, it looks to me as though food is the weak link. And more often than not, it was food shortages that undermined earlier civilizations like the Sumerians, the Mayans, and so forth. What we are creating is, in a sense, a food bubble. Most of us know about the housing bubble that developed in this country and the effect it had when it burst and housing prices dropped by 30%. That was caused by over-lending. The food bubble was caused by over-pumping and over-plowing, and they both have economic consequences. When the housing bubble burst, housing prices fell 30%. When the food bubble burst, we will see rises in food prices. No one knows exactly how much they will rise and exactly when a big jump will come. One of the questions that we address in World on the Edge is the question of how much time do we have before we get into serious trouble in the relationship between the economy and its natural support systems. The answer is we don't know, but I think it could come at any time now. It's not something that won't happen until 20 or 30 years from now or the end of the century. It could come any year. Let me just give a couple of examples of how it could happen. We all followed very closely the heat wave in Western Russia this past year, a heat wave that began in late June and lasted well into to August, 6-7 weeks of unremitting high temperatures. that heat wave reduced the Russian grain crop from 100 million tons to 60 million tons, roughly a 40% drop. That was enough to raise grain prices 60%, and it led to a rise in food prices, where when FAO issued its December World Food Index, price index, it showed that it was the highest on record, higher even than in 2007, 2008, when we had the enormous run-up in prices. But in a sense, we were fortunate that was centered in Moscow, because if it had been centered in Chicago and the U.S. had lost 40% of its grain harvest, it would have been 40% of 400 million tons or 160 million tons. If that had happened, we would now have chaos in world grain markets. We would have seen prices of grain and food literally go off the top of the chart, because it would have dropped grain stocks to the lowest level in history by far, much lower than in 2007 when the low level of stocks triggered that run-up in prices. What we would see is exporting countries restricting exports in an effort to keep their food prices down. We would see oil exporting countries that import grain trying to barter oil for grain to make sure they got grain, and there would be many other countries left out. It would put enormous stress on the international economic system. Another option is that heat wave could have been centered in Beijing. If it had been centered in Beijing, in the North China Plain, which is China's major grain-producing region, it could also have reduced China's grain harvest by 40%, which also happens to be 400 million tons. The Chinese and U.S. grain harvest are almost exactly the same at 400 million tons. If China had lost 160 million tons of grain and come into the world market big time, as it would have had to if the heat wave had been there, it would have come to the United States for grain, because the U.S. is far and away the world's largest grain exporter. For American consumers, that would be a nightmare scenario, because we'd be looking at the prospect of competing with 1.4 billion Chinese with rapidly rising incomes for our grain harvest, driving up our grain prices. Now, historically, when faced with situations like that, as in the 1970s, we restricted exports. But China is our banker. There are limits to what we can do in limiting Chinese access to our grain harvest. So Americans, who've never had to worry about food security at the national level, at least, might suddenly realize that food security is something that is of concern to us and to everyone in the world. We have seen grain price surges in the past, going back over the last half century. Almost all of them were associated with a particular weather event, a monsoon failure in India, or a heat and drought in Russia, or an intense heat wave in the U.S. Midwest. And almost always in those cases, after a year, things would go back to normal. But the problem we now have is that there's no norm to go back to. The world's climate is in the process of change. It's in flux. And what we're also looking at now is not an event-driven rise in grain prices, but a trend-driven rise. Just to look quickly on both sides of the food population equation. On the demand side, we have population growth, of course, which has been with us for a long time. But we are now, tonight at the dinner table, there will be 219,000 people who were not there last night. And again, tomorrow night, there'll be another 219,000 people there, many of them, incidentally, with empty plates. This is a relentless growth in demand that's beginning to make it difficult. It's pressing against the skills of farmers and land and water resources. Then we have rising affluence. There are probably 3 billion people in the world today trying to move up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive meat, milk, and eggs. China's total meat consumption is now double that of the United States, just to give a sense of how that market is growing. The third source of demand for food is converting grain to oil, basically grain to ethanol. And most of that's occurring in the United States, where about 119 million tons of this year's harvest of 400 million tons will be converted into fuel for cars. That was actually up to a few million tons in the USDA report this morning. From 1990 to 2005, the average annual growth in world grain consumption was 21 million tons per year. From 2005 to 2010, it was 41 million tons. The annual growth in world grain demand has roughly doubled during the last decade or two. On the supply side, we have several trends that are making it more difficult to expand food production. The most imminent of these is aquifer depletion. Half the world's people now live in countries where water tables are falling as a result of overpumping. In Saudi Arabia, we've seen literally the collapse of its wheat production in the last few years as a result of aquifer depletion. For more than 20 years, Saudi Arabia was self-sufficient in wheat, producing nearly 3 million tons a year. And then in just the last few years, it's dropped from 3 million tons to less than 1 million tons, and another 2 years will probably be gone altogether. And Saudi Arabia will be totally dependent on grain imports. In India, according to World Bank numbers, 175 million people are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. For China, the similar number is 130 million people. And one could go on through a list of countries, but this water-based food bubble is a serious issue. And there are several countries now where grain production is declining, including one entire geographic region, namely the Arab Middle East. And among the countries there, in addition to Saudi Arabia, where the grain harvest is shrinking because of shrinking water supplies, are Syria, Iraq, and now probably Yemen as well. So this is the first geographic region where we have seen an actual downturn in grain production as a result of water shortages. Soil erosion. There are two huge dust bowls forming now in the world. One is in northern China, western Mongolia, and central Asia. The other is in central Africa. You can track the dust storms originating in these areas each year through satellite images. In Mongolia and Lesotho, the grain harvest has dropped by more than half over the last decade or two as a result of soil erosion. Agriculture in Lesotho is collapsing. Other countries with serious soil erosion problems include Haiti, of course, North Korea, and there are many others. A third factor that's making it more difficult to expand production in addition to aquifer depletion and soil erosion is rising temperature. The rule of thumb that crop ecologists use in assessing the effect of higher temperature on grain yields is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature above the optimum during the growing season, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. And we saw that operating this year in Western Russia. Another constraint on production that has emerged, and it gets almost no attention in the press, is that the backlog of unused agricultural technology in the more agriculturally advanced countries has largely disappeared. And what this is leading to is a plateauing of grain yields. In countries like France, Germany, the United Kingdom, where wheat yields were climbing for several decades, during the last several years, almost a decade now, they've flattened and they're no longer increasing at all. The same thing has happened with rice yields in Japan and could be starting with rice yields in China. But this simply means that farmers can no longer find new technologies to raise their land productivity. They're using everything that's available. So this is yet another reason why the higher grain prices that we saw in 2007, 2008, and then it never really went back to normal, and that we're seeing now, are probably going to be with us for some time to come. These are trend-driven rises, not event-driven. In looking at the future, there are three indicators that I think are worth tracking. One is economic, namely grain prices. I think what happens to grain prices this year and the next few years are going to tell us a lot about our future. The second trend that is worth watching is a social trend, the number of hungry people in the world. That number during the closing decades of the last century was declining. It is now rising. It has been rising throughout this decade. It bottomed out at about 825 million and has now climbed up to roughly a billion. The third trend that I think is worth tracking is a political trend. The number of failing states in the world. That number has been growing longer each year now for the last several years. Countries like Yemen or Haiti or Afghanistan, the Sudan. This increase in the number of failing states raises a rather disturbing question, which is how many failing states before our global civilization begins to unravel? We don't know the answer to that. We haven't been here before. This is an entirely new situation for us. What I think these trends, and we don't have to go beyond the food economy, what I think these trends mean is that we need to redefine security. We have a legacy from the last century which indicates that military threats are the big threats to our security. This is because during the last century, the century was dominated by two world wars and a Cold War. And so we've come to think of security almost exclusively in military terms. But the big threats to our future today, the threats to civilization itself, are not military. There is no huge armed aggressor someplace that we need to be worried about. What we do need to be worried about is climate change, spreading water shortages, soil erosion, population growth. These are the new threats to our future. These are the threats to our security. We need to be thinking about how to stabilize climate. We're already beginning to see what it translates into in terms of food security. We think we have to cut carbon emissions 80%, not by 2050, which is what political leaders like to talk about, but by 2020. If we want to have a chance of saving the Greenland ice sheet, we have to move fast. And that means restructuring the world energy economy. It means shifting from fossil fuels, from oil and coal and gas, to wind, solar, and geothermal. And it's doable. And the key to restructuring the energy economy is to get the market to tell the environmental truth. And we can do that by restructuring taxes, lower income taxes, and raise the carbon tax so that the price of coal, for example, of burning coal, reflects not only the cost of mining the coal, but also the cost of climate change associated with burning the coal. So restructuring taxes is the key to restructuring the energy economy. We see a world where we would build maybe 2 million wind turbines, 2 megawatts each, and that would be enough basically to back out coal-fired power. Entirely doable. I mean, 2 million sounds like a lot, but we produce 70 million cars every year in the world, and we're talking about 2 million turbines over the next decade. We could produce those turbines on assembly lines that have been, automobile assembly lines that have been closed in the United States alone. We could do that for the world. It's entirely doable. The other things we have to focus on are population stabilization, poverty eradication, and restoring the Earth's natural systems, forests and soils, grasslands, fisheries, aquifers, and so forth. It's doable, but we need to do it quickly. We're looking at the need for universal primary school education for girls as well as for boys. We're looking at the need for at least rudimentary health care in developing countries. We need reproductive health care and family planning services. These are all doable. We need also to, as I mentioned, restore the natural support systems. That means soil conservation, planting trees. It means raising water productivity. We need to be doing today for water what we did for land beginning a half century ago. In the 1950s, we began focusing on the enormous growth in world population that was then coming out of the United Nations, the projections coming out of the United Nations, and realized that even then we didn't have a lot of new land to turn to. So we focused on raising land productivity. As a result, world grain yields tripled between 1950 and 2010. We need to begin thinking about how to raise water productivity in the worldwide systematic, sustained way, and we have not yet done that. How much does all this cost? It costs quite a bit. The combination of primary school education, rudimentary health care, family planning services, soil conservation, planting trees, all these things come to about $200 billion a year in additional expenditures. Now, $200 billion is a lot, particularly in the world where we're looking at deficits, fiscal deficits almost everywhere. But what we're talking about is basically saving civilization. We're talking about turning around the trends that are undermining our future. And $200 billion is less than one-third of the U.S. military budget. It is only one-eighth of the global military budget. And I don't think it's that difficult to make a convincing argument that we need to address the new threats to our future, and that military is obviously something we need to be concerned with, but it's by no means the dominant threat to our future. And the $200 billion is basically a price tag to save civilization. And it's not a matter of whether we can afford it or not. How can we not afford to make the effort, given the stakes? We have the knowledge. We know what needs to be done. We know what's happening. We have the resources. We only need to redefine security to free up the resources we need to stabilize population, to conserve soil, to plant trees, and so forth. We have the resources to do that. We have the knowledge, we have the resources. What we need is leadership. And if we're going to do this, I think the United States is going to have to lead, and I think President Obama is the point person here. If he does not step forward on these issues, if he does not recognize the extent of the risks we're now facing and the urgency of responding to them, then I think it's going to be very difficult for the world to respond. But one of our challenges, and one of my challenges, and I hope one of yours, will be to help mobilize the support that's needed to make these changes. They're doable. We can do them, but we have to move fast. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention, and I'll be happy to take any questions. I would note that the book World on the Edge is now online at earthpolicy.org. And so if you want to take a quick look at it, it's there for your reference and can be downloaded.
And we'll take our first question from Tom Philpott at Grist.
Hi. I was wondering if we could get Lester to comment on the prospects for technology going forward. I mean, I think if you listen to people like Tom Vilsack and Hillary Clinton and executives in the biotechnology industry, the problems that Lester outlined are going to be solved by these sort of new wonder seeds that are coming up that are going to be drought tolerant, you know, nitrogen efficient. And I would like to get Lester's perspective on those prospects.
Yes. Tom, up until now, most of the advances in biotechnology have not been yield increasing. They have been to develop resistance to diseases or insects like the corn borer or the cotton boll weevil, and they've been very successful in doing that. They have also been successful in developing soybean varieties, for example, that are herbicide resistant. So you can actually use herbicides to control weeds in soybeans the same way you do in, say, corn. But these have not increased yields or output very much. They have served other purposes. And one of the difficulties that plant breeders have now with biotechnology or conventional breeding is that most of the big things we could think of to do to raise grain yields, for example, have already been done by conventional plant breeders. And what we are now looking at is the possibility, for example, of developing more drought-tolerant strains, and we may get a 5 or 10 or 15% increase in yields as a result of that, or more cold-tolerant strains, so we can move the corn belt a bit further north, for example. But most of these all the ones that I know of are sort of marginal in the sense they don't double or triple yields as the dwarf wheats and rices did in the back in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. We're going to, you know, sort of nickel and dime our way along here. I just don't see anything with dramatic gains. And we can also say, you know, we've been, I've forgotten exactly how long we've had genetically modified crops, seeds on the market, but it's probably 15 years or so now, but we still don't have any dramatic jump in production, nor do I think we will get a dramatic jump. We'll get little bits here and there, and they'll be important, but nothing to write home about.
And moving on, we'll take our next question from Tiffany Stecker at ClimateWire.
Thanks, Lester. My question is related in part to the first question that was asked. Are the solutions to the impending food bubble, are they already present? It's just a question of applying them, or is there a need for more research? And that said, how are we going to shorten the lags between research and implementation?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind here is that the rise in food prices we're faced with now is not just a single thing. I mean, the heat wave in Russia obviously triggered this because we're already pretty close to the edge. But what we have to keep in mind is that the solutions to the food security challenge that we're facing are not trivial ones. They're not fine-tuning plant breeding or what have you. They involve stabilizing climate. They involve reversing the deforestation of the planet. They involve soil conservation programs like the one we adopted in this country in the 1930s during the midst of the Dust Bowl, for example. So there are no quick and easy solutions. It's dealing with climate change and population growth and soil erosion, a whole complex of issues that are going to take a concerted worldwide effort, hopefully with the United States providing the lead.
And moving on, we'll take our next question from Felix von Geyer at Platts.
Hello, Lester.
Hi, Felix.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Good, good. Now, we met at the World Energy Congress back in September, and you were discussing, along with Ivo Dubois, the fact that the old industry, the fossil fuels people, are sort of coming up with Plan A to invest about $30 trillion over the next couple of decades to basically give them good ROI. But there is no Plan B as to how they're going to actually meet, say, 2050 climate targets. And I wake up in the new year this year, and I just see, like, nothing but competition for oil in the peak oil age and rare earth elements industry needs for a variety of purposes. And I'm just thinking, how are we going to get this kind of turnaround that you're suggesting we do need by 2020? I think it's more than just the switch to renewable energy. Do you want to expand more?
Yeah. What we're seeing in the United States right now, what we've been seeing for the last 3 or 4 years, is an extraordinarily effective anti-coal campaign. And that's responding in part to the fact that most people don't like coal. A poll was taken not too long ago asking people, you know, where they like their electricity come from. They were giving, you know, 4, 5, or 6 options, and coal got 3% of the vote. People don't like coal, and this is one reason why this movement to, one, prevent the construction of new coal-fired power plants, and now as it moves into phase 2 to close the existing ones, has been so successful. If we look at the last 3 years, for example, coal use has actually gone down 8% already, and there are another 48 plants announced this past year that will be closed in the not-too-distant future. At the same time, we brought online about 300 new wind farms with some 21,000 megawatts of generating capacity. So the lines have crossed, and they're heading in the right direction, and they're not moving fast enough yet. And as everyone knows, coal plants are still being built in some parts of the world, like China and, to a lesser degree, India. So that's one of the things. The other thing is we have some exciting new technologies now to reduce energy use. We see it in the lighting sector, for example, where we're moving from incandescents to compact fluorescents. That cuts electricity use by 75%. Now we have LEDs coming on the market that takes it down closer to 90%. And the exciting thing is, and if you look at the projections, Philips, for example, one of the world's largest bulb manufacturers, is projecting that by 2015, half of all the bulbs being sold in the United States and in Europe will be LEDs. And by 2020, they expect LEDs to be taking 80% of the market. And since incandescents are being phased out and banned in so many countries, it means that by 2020, it'll be mostly either CFLs or LEDs. That alone would enable us to close 700 of the world's 2,400 coal-fired power plants. Another exciting possibility is the electrification of transport systems. This comes with light rail in cities, high-speed interrail among cities, and we're seeing this developing very well in Europe and now just sort of exploding in China. And then we have the possibility of plug-in hybrid cars and all-electric cars, which I think are going to move much faster than most people think as the gravity of the climate threat continues to increase in the years ahead. So a lot of the things, a lot of the trends that we're seeing are not always getting that much attention, but I think we're going to see a lot of change in a rather short period of time.
We'll take our next question from Jennifer Hunter at the Toronto Star.
Hi, Lester. I'm calling from your largest trading partner, Canada, and we have a situation here where we produce a lot of food, wheat, and oil. We have a small population. What about countries like us? What can we do to mitigate the food crisis that we are approaching?
I would look at it in two ways. One, what can be done within Canada to expand food production? And my sense is that in the absence of some more cold-tolerant corn varieties, for example, that Canada is going pretty much full tilt in producing wheat and oil seeds and so forth. The big thing with Canada right now, I think, is the tar sands issue. And the carbon intensity of oil that comes from tar sands. And not to mention the extraordinary pollution and disruption that it causes in the more locally. And one of the things that's happening in the States now is that the movement to ban new coal-fired power plants is beginning to expand to oppose the pipelines and so forth needed to move the high-carbon oil from Athabasca to the States. One of the major lines that's being contested now is one that would cross the border in the U.S. Midwest and go all the way down to oil refineries in Texas. When I look at Canada and I look at climate change in the future, I think Canada's biggest contribution to future food security is to begin to move away from the tar sands oil.
But there are many ways that we could probably contribute to helping food shortages since we do, putting aside the oil sands for a moment, we have a whole huge Midwest area where we grow wheat and other crops. And in southern Ontario, where I live, we have a fruit belt, and we export a lot of this. So is there any role that we can play in helping countries that are running short of food?
It seems to me that in terms of production, Canada is doing the right things. One of the things to think about is a consumer-related food issue, which is moving down the food chain. Diets in Canada and the U.S. are very similar, and we are living unhealthily high on the food chain. We don't necessarily have to become vegetarians, but just moving down the food chain somewhat to a healthier diet for us would free up resources for, particularly grain resources, for the rest of the world. That would be my principal suggestion there. Another thing on the energy front is that one of Canada's greatest resources is wind. I would guess that the ratio of wind to population, that is the per capita supply of wind power in Canada, is about the highest in the world. I can't think of any other country that has so much wind and so few people as Canada does. And the electricity produced from that wind is exportable to the United States. And I would suggest concentrating on that rather than the Athabasca tar sands, because that wind will never run out. And one of the exciting things about investing in renewable sources of energy instead of fossil fuels, as Felix was mentioning a few minutes ago, is that for the first time since the Industrial Revolution began, we can invest in energy sources that will in effect last as long as the Earth itself. Now, wind farms, you know, the bearings have to be replaced from time to time, and there's the maintenance thing. But once you get the wind farms and the transmission infrastructure in place, it's there indefinitely. And that's a great legacy to leave the next generation, sources of energy that will never run out. I mean, one of the reasons that Texas has become the leading generator of electricity from wind in the United States, it passed California, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, is because there's a lot of oil money now going into wind farms in Texas. And the reason is that it's become a very attractive investment. If you invest in a new oil field, you know that, you know, the wells are going to go dry eventually, and you have to find another oil field. But if you invest in a wind farm, you've got an investment that can essentially last forever.
Thank you.
Now we'll take our next question from Janessa Stemke at Sustain the Nation.
This was also the question before last. I read Plan B 4.0, and there's a lot of discussion on alternative energy, clean energy, energy efficiency, which is great. But I didn't see anything on energy conservation, education, and things that people can do immediately without any investment or installation of technology. Things like turning off the lights and unplugging appliances. And I'm wondering if Earth Policy Institute does anything with energy conservation to show people that sustainability is easy and cost-effective. And it'll also reduce the total amount of emissions that we need to transition to alternatives and clean energy. So it'll make it easier to restructure our energy system. And it doesn't require any new technologies like installation of anything.
Right. Good point. We, in Plan B 4.0, we're concentrating on the large sort of macro issues, but the potential for conserving energy is huge. I mean, just to cite one example, to the extent you can substitute a bike for a car, for example, which a lot of people are doing these days in the U.S. and throughout the world, particularly in major cities. And I know Toronto has a very good, biking system. There are a lot of important things we can do using bikes more and cars less. As one who lives very happily without a car in Washington, D.C., it's sort of nice to be able to walk places and to, and we have a good metro system here. And if someone were to give me a car, I wouldn't accept it. It's just, they're just not worth the trouble in my mind. So you're right. There are many things we can do. Another favorite of mine is substituting ceiling fans for air conditioning in the summertime. You can do that, and I actually prefer ceiling fans to air conditioning and save an enormous amount of money, particularly at the when we're facing peak energy demands in the summer in the United States. So you're right. There's a long list of things we can do that don't require any action by governments or anything, but we can do as individuals, and they all count.
And next we'll take a question from Stacey Feldman at Solve Climate News.
Hi, thank you for holding this call.
My pleasure.
In your view, how important is slowing corn ethanol production in the U.S. to staving off potential bubble burst in the food sector? Thank you.
It's an important question and one that's not gotten enough attention here in Washington. As you probably know, the Congress extended the tax breaks on ethanol for another year. What we now know is that what seemed like a good idea in 1978 after the oil export embargo, because we had quite a bit of idle cropland then, and the idea of using that to produce fuel for cars seemed like a good idea. But we don't have any idle cropland anymore. That all ended in 1995. So if you use more land to produce fuel for cars, you have less to produce food for people or feed for livestock and poultry. And the amount of grain it takes to fuel cars is extraordinary. The grain required to fill a 25-gallon SUV tank with ethanol is enough to feed a person for a year at average world consumption levels. Or, if you want to look at it in macro terms, if we were to use the entire U.S. grain harvest to produce fuel for cars, it would cover 18% of our automotive fuel needs. So it's not a solution. And when you look at the economics and the land use efficiency, you realize that wind energy is just so much more attractive. For example, a farmer in northern Iowa can plant an acre of land to corn and produce maybe $1,000 worth of ethanol. He can also put a wind turbine on that acre of land and produce $300,000 worth of electricity in a year. So when it comes to the land use efficiency of energy production, there's no competition, really. It's wind all the way. And the reason wind is so popular with farmers and ranchers is that they can continue to grow corn or wheat on their land because the wind turbines in a wind farm area only occupy 1% of the land area. So the rest there is still free to use. So for a lot of farmers, the idea of double cropping their land, producing electricity from wind and running cattle or planting wheat or corn is a very attractive option. And this is why we see farmers not only in the Midwest and ranchers in the Great Plains and so forth, but places like dairy farming regions in upstate New York, where farmers are really excited about the possibility of having a few wind turbines on their farm to earn them royalties of maybe $10,000 a year each.
And we'll take our next question from Daphne Weisham at Earthbeat Radio.
Hi, thank you, Lester. This has been a fascinating and I just wanted to get to the political dynamic you sort of touch on at the end of your opening remarks where you said, you know, the ball is really in Obama's court. And, you know, unfortunately, as you know, we have a Congress that's in denial about climate change and a country that's fearful about our economic future. So the idea of a $200 billion a year fund or a tax on natural resources, as much as I agree, this is you know, in theory doable. What we have is a political climate where we can barely keep intact our EPA authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and, of course, the Supreme Court ruling allowing unlimited campaign contributions from corporations. So I guess my question for you is, you know, given these political obstacles and the short timeline, what do you suggest we should be doing in this current political climate?
The thing to keep in mind is that change comes very quickly and unexpectedly at times. And in thinking about social and political change, I have sort of three models that I use. One is the Pearl Harbor model, where if you'd conducted a poll on December 6, 1941, and asked the American people, should we get involved in the war or not, probably 95% would have said no, nothing doing. But if you'd asked that same question on December 8th, probably 95% would have said yes, we have to go to war. And the thing that changed, of course, was the very successful, from a military strategic point of view, of the Japanese attack on the U.S. fleet in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And that changed everything. Now, with climate change, for example, if we reach the point where we have a Pearl Harbor, it might be too late. Another model that I use is I call it the Berlin Wall model, where you have attitudes changing and opposition building and building and building until suddenly everything changes. And the visual manifestation of a political revolution in Eastern Europe was the Berlin Wall coming down. But the interesting thing was no one saw it coming. You can't find a single article in the political science journals written in the 1980s saying, you know, there's a big change coming in Eastern Europe. And after the wall came down, the White House called in the intelligence community leaders here in Washington and asked, you know, how come they didn't warn them about this? Well, not only could the agency not warn the administration, they had trouble explaining it after it happened. And that's what tipping points are like. You can't, they're sometimes difficult to define, but even when you define them, it's hard to tell exactly when they're coming. And I think we're, as climate events continue to unfold, that we're going to see a major shift in public opinion despite the heavily funded climate denial campaign. At some point, it'll just become obvious to everyone. And here I go back and remember the smoking and health issue in the closing decades of the last century. And right up until the end, the tobacco company CEOs were willing to testify under oath that there was no proof of a link between smoking and health. And then suddenly everything changed almost overnight, and the industry agreed to compensate state governments to the tune of $254 billion. That's almost $1,000 for every person in the United States. And no one could have seen that or saw that coming. So change comes very quickly sometimes. I mean, in the mid-90s, there was no lobby in Washington stronger than the tobacco lobby. And now there's hardly any major lobby at all on tobacco. And don't forget that the book is online and the press release online at earthpolicy.org.
Thank you all.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You just heard a press conference with Lester R. Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute. He is launching his new book, World on Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. It was recorded January 12, 2010. Find out more at earthpolicy.org.